communicating with the president. Well, yeah, is it on?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll tell you about that later.
Okay. This has been Trollinger. I'm sitting with Harvey Miller in San Marcos, Texas at... What time is it, Harvey? It's 2:11 on February 4th.
Yeah.
Okay, last time we talked about where you grew up. You gave your full name and date of birth. Maybe if you could just repeat your full name and date of birth, and then we'll start in on some other questions.
Okay, my name is Harvey Miller. And I guess I might have told you the last time, and my original name is Harvey Ursi Miller.
Right.
We talked about that. And
you had it changed.
I changed it. My grandma here was named Ursi. My grandpa, my mama's dad was named Harvey, and her mama was named Ursi, so she named me Harvey Ursi Miller.
Yeah.
And when I was in high school, they kept calling me a sissy because of that name. So
right.
When I got my Social Security card, later I changed to Harvey Edwin Miller because they said you have to, Harvey E. Miller, and I said you got to fill that E out. So Harvey Edwin Miller, born in Oglesby, Texas, while mom and dad was on the cotton, picking cotton, and then, of course, it's kind of like in Georgetown, November 4th, 1929. And, of course, then I grew up in Georgetown, and then it was an area from Georgetown. I don't know if it's still there or not. They refer to it as Rocky Hollow, because I know they got the Rocky Hollow Cemetery up there. You ever heard of that area, Rocky Hollow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You told me about it last
time. Yeah, okay, Rocky Hollow. And they got the Rocky Hollow Cemetery there where some of my people buried. So I grew up, went to school there, and I grew up, and then went to Carver School and graduated from Carver School in 1948. And kind of unusual, but then I ended up getting married in 1948 to my high school sweetheart, Arabelle Jefferson, at that time. And I started getting involved in things, you know, at that time. Started to get involved in Boy Scouts and a lot of things in the community after we got married. And then, of course, prior to that time is when I followed suit to integrate to school. Well, within we followed suit to integrate to school because we was already married and had some kids. And the reason of this was, I hadn't thought about it, because at that time, as I probably said the last time, there was a lot of times we had a lot of problems in the South at that time, where there was a lot of racial things going on in Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama and so on. But when my wife, president of the Carver PTA, asked for a new Carver school, because it was about to fall down there on the bluffs of the Blue Hole, when it came out in the paper, and I think I showed you that article, and I got it in my book I made, Carver PTA asked for a new school. And when it came out in the paper, it says $142,000 to build a new Carver school. And a group of white people from the Southwestern University there got together and called a meeting. And then they called me and they said, Harvey said, I know you're involved in a lot of things, but we need to meet with you. And I said, for what? When they mentioned that, you know, and then it kind of shocked me. I almost had a heart attack when they said, it's time to integrate it. We're not going to pay our taxpayers money for no segregated school. And it just shocked me. And so the committee for and they called it the Committee for Better Schools, and we started meeting on a regular basis. And that's when we decided that at the end of that time, and I got a lot of articles in the booklet that I made. And that's why we ended up going to court. And, of course, we went to court, and I always say this, the day that we were in court, Southwest Texas, then, this was filing suit to integrate at the same time. So that case was in right in front of ours. And I remember the lawyer calling me and said, Ms. Miller said, we're going to court tomorrow. Have you ever tried to go to school up there? I said, no. I never tried to go to school up there. I said, why? He said, well, if we get Mr. Barnes, Superintendent Barnes, on the stand and start drilling him about integration and all that, probably the first thing he's going to say is, well, how do they know they never tried to come up there? So the next day, man, the pastor, Reverend Gibbons, took a group of kids, 29 kids up there to the high school to arrest them. And when we got up there, the people at the rest where we arrested them and said, why you bring these kids up here? We can't take these colored kids up here. Why you want to bring them up here? Well, it's when I kind of got into a little trouble with my oldest daughter. I think I remember telling you, she's about 12 years old, and she's passed on now, Chris. And I said, my daughter here wants to be a doctor. And I said, they don't have no chemistry, no science, and nothing like that. If you're going to be a doctor, you need that. in your background when you go to college, so and so, you know. And I remember my daughter looked up at me like that, and I patted her on the head. And of course, when I got outside, I asked, "Why were you looking at me like that?" She said, "I was going to ask you who said I wanted to be a doctor." I said, "You're going to mess up my story." But then we went on to talk a little bit, and then the next day, an article come out in the paper with me. I got that article. Article comes out in Williams County Sun, 29 Negroes turned down at Georgetown High. So when a lawyer called me and asked me about it, I went ahead and sent him a copy of that, and he said, "That's all we need." And so that's when we went to college. We went on to court and in Austin, and when we got there, they ruled a grade a year. And that wouldn't do my kids any good. First grade this year, take 12 grades for full integration. First grade this year, and the second grade next year, and the second grade, and on and on and on. And so we got together again and decided to, with our lawyer, Price Ashton out of Austin, we got together and had another meeting. And that's when we decided to, I guess my grandson might have picked it up. That's okay. We had this meeting, and that's when we decided we'd go before the Fifth Circuit Court. And that was one of the highest courts in the Fifth Circuit down in Louisiana somewhere. And they ruled freedom of choice. Any colored kid wanting to go to the white school can go, and any colored kid wanting to stay at Carver can stay. And that's where we ended up at. And next thing I know, we was integrated.
You mentioned that there's a Southwestern group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the phrase you used was that you almost had a heart attack when they asked you that we need to. Could you describe that a little more in more detail? I think that's kind of, who was this group at Southwestern?
Well, it was a group of teachers and people in administration. I don't think in my article, and I'll show you the article, I don't think in the article it specifically said, well, as a matter of fact, I do have pictures of some of them that was on the board.
Mm-hmm.
I have pictures of them because I got them out of a university annual and have pictures of them. And they just the general people in Georgetown hadn't said anything about it, but just when this came out in the paper at the university, Southwestern University, is when it happened, and that's when a bunch of teachers and things got together, and I got some of them. And when I went back up there to Georgetown, we had a Carver reunion, and I brought that up, and some of those people come down, and they had forgot all about that. You'd be surprised if so many people had forgotten about that. And I had to go and get my booklet and bring it out and show it to them. And they just like had a heart attack because they look at that. Yeah, that's me. I said, well, that's your name, ain't it? That's my name. That's me, you know. And they was, but I didn't know why they were so interested all of a sudden, you know. And that's so when they called, when that came out in the paper, the Georgetown paper, and they called me, you know, like I was involved in a lot of things even back then in the community. And that's when they called me and said, Harvey said, we know you're involved in a lot of things, but we need to meet with you. And I said, why? He said, well, we saw the article in the paper, and we're not going to pay our taxpayers' money for no segregated school. It's time to integrate. And that's when I almost had a heart attack, because I'm thinking about all the things that happened in the South at that time, Louisiana, Mississippi, and then all of a sudden, you know, they want to integrate. I said, I can't believe it, you know. I thought, oh, my God, what? And I was all for it, you know, because that was what it was all about. And when we called this meeting, and they called it, they named it the Committee for Better Schools. And that's where we got started from.
So that's how you came to have such a prominent role in desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
You were a guy who was involved in the community, people knew who you were, and then these kind of Southwestern teachers or faculty or whatever
mm-hmm.
saw an article about this article on the Carver School possibly getting some taxpayer money to fix it.
Yeah, $142,000, yes, to rebuild a new Carver school.
And they said, to heck with that, we want to, it's time to integrate. And they called you.
They called me.
So, describe maybe, to give me kind of a little understanding, why they picked Harvey Miller, or why they called Harvey Miller.
Well, you know, it's kind of unusual. Like I say, I was involved in quite a few things in the paper, and I guess I didn't realize they recognized me. And one thing that I don't know at that time, I ended up being a cook at the L&M Cafe, and at that time I cooked at Southwestern University for a while. And I don't know if they got relation to me then, but now, but and I don't know how many articles came out in the paper. I had a few articles come out in the paper about organized first Black Boy Scouts and Park and Recreation. I got an article where I organized kind of a park recreation program on that for that side of town. At that time, we lived on the ridge. It was the three sections that Black people lived in at that time. It was on the ridge, grasshopper, and the track. And down the ridge was down there where the school is, down where the Carver School was down in there. And then grasshopper was further back up and all like that. So when they saw that article in the paper that it's going to cost $142,000, I think, something like that, to build this new Carver School, because it was beginning to fall down, you know. And that's when the article when the people from the university called and saw that article in the paper. And I got a copy of that article, and they saw that article in the paper. That's when they said, what, you know, like, we're not going to pay our taxpayer money for no Syracuse school. It's time to integrate, you know, something like that.
In the name of the group, with these teachers or at Southwestern, you, other people, what was the name of that group?
The Committee for Better School. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Committee for Better School, that's what they named it.
So you said you supported integration. Up until that point, you know, what did you think should have been done? I mean, were you all for repairing Carver, or did you kind of feel, were you kind of feeling the same way as the professors?
Well, at that time, I was feeling that way, professors. At that time, at that young age, I was trying to integrate things in, and I didn't realize it, you know, at my age. When I organized my Boy Scouts, the Black Boy Scouts could only go to Camp Tone Wooden the last week of the month. That's where they had it set up. White kids go all up, you know, down in Austin, Camp Tone Wooden in Austin. And at the last time, then we'd go the last weekends. So I would, you know, I was just feeling all this circulation in different ways, you know. Being a cook, and Black people had to come in the kitchen and eat in the back kitchen because they couldn't eat up front. And so I was just very sensitive to all the little things that was happening before segregation was going, you know. And Black people had to live on this side of town, you know, and things of that nature. So even at that age, I was just sensitive to that. And I was keeping up with some of the things that was happening in the South, you know, at that time.
Were you anxious at all to take on such a prominent role?
Yeah, I was. I was just all excited about it, and I was ready to get started. And after we started to get some more Black people involved in it, you know, and some of them kind of opposed it because they didn't like the idea of losing their connection with the Black kid. They thought there'd be better connection with the Black student and the Black teacher than it would if it went to integrated school. And I was reading an article a while ago, and then I'll give you a copy of that booklet that explain all this, and that, you know, some of the parents and students didn't want, they still wanted their Carver School because they wanted that connection, you know. And matter of fact, it was a little committee formed against it, and one of them was my cousin, and he was a teacher. His name was Charlie Miller, and he opposed it. He kind of formed a committee to oppose it, but by that time we'd got to a certain degree that it just went on to, you know, to being totally integrated. And I think it was in, I guess, 65 when we, 58 when we asked for the school, and then 62, 63, and 64 we just went all over making the changes and getting involved and everything. And like I say, I got articles to back all that up, you know, in a booklet I put together.
It seems that, in a way, taking such a prominent position at the effort to integrate Georgetown schools didn't just put you maybe crossways with some of the people in the white community, but also some of the people in the Black community as well. I mean, you just mm-hmm. mentioned that
yeah.
they didn't all agree, they weren't all on the yeah. same page. So that must have put you real kind of in an awkward position at times, but so why did you keep going? I mean,
well, I just felt it was the best thing to do, because I was already feeling that, and I kind of made a statement, and even some of the articles, I just wanted to better educate for my girls. Because of because we got all the leftover stuff from the high school, you know, all the stuff that used books, and the stuff that they used for the home economics, a little bit, had a little of that home economics there, and we got all that, and we didn't get a lot of new stuff, you know, so because we used, and so we just felt the need for it, And a lot of times I think about, you know, now I'm 79, soon be 80, and I keep thinking about why I was so sensitive to things way back at that time, you know. I was just sensitive to things, and just insert this in. One day I was riding to Austin on a Greyhound bus. And at that time, black people had to sit in the back seat. And if there wasn't no seat there, you had to stand up back there. And I was on my way to Austin that day, and the seat was full, so I deliberately come up front and stood up and was standing right behind the driver, kind of holding on to the little rail, you know, looking down like that and stuff like that, and I was kind of playing a game. And there wasn't many white people there. And this little white lady sat kind of behind me, and she said, why are you standing up? I said, our seat's all full. And so instead of me standing up back there, I thought I'd stand up here and watch the scenery, you know, on CNN. She said, well, what does it look like? I said, well, it looks cool out there and everything. And she said, come sit down here. I didn't know what to do. She said, I'll sit down beside her. And some of the other white people looking back and saying, I guess they're saying, what are you doing sitting over there? But when we got to Austin, you know, I got out and I thanked and everything. And I was just kind of pulling little tricks like that, you know, like I say, when I organized the Boy Scouts. And I think I said this earlier. When I organized the Boy Scouts, that Black Boy Scout Troop 155, and black students supposed to go to Camp Tomwood in the last week of the month, and I deliberately took my 12 or 13 kids down there early, and I got some pictures of that, and so a little article on that, a book, and I took them down there, well, in the middle of the week. When I get down there and about to pull them up there, and the guy said, at the gate said, sir, said, you can't bring, your colored kids don't come till next week. And I said, oh, my God, what are we going to do? These kids are going to be so disappointed and everything, you know, and I was going on and on, playing a game, like. And the man at the gate there said, sir, come over here. I said, your name's Harvey what? I said, Harvey Miller. He said, and I told him, explained to him, and he said, I'll tell you what, I said, we got one booth down there that nobody showed up in. Go ahead and take your students down there, your scouts down there. I took my scout and put them in that booth. And that was the first time that black scouts, colored scouts, and white scouts had ever been together like that. And I tell you, they just had a fun. They just you would think maybe they'd be fussing and something like that, cause never, but they just got together. And for that whole weekend, 3 days, I think, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we just had a fun. So I was just kind of pulling little tricks like that.
When you decided to take kind of a leadership role in desegregation, did people ever threaten you or in any way?
No, never did. And I thought, I kept thinking about that. Some of my people kind of worried about it. There were some people on the school board that really opposed it and got a little rude about it. And they really opposed it. They didn't want segregation. They was on the school board. Now, I don't know if I'm supposed to call their name or not. But, and I was looking at it in the story there, and you see it in there. I don't think specifically stated that how they opposed it, but I think in some of the arcs might have. Jay Wolf. At that time, I think he owned a ranch out there. Jay Wolf was really against integration. And he put forth a lot of effort to try to stop it, you know. And then Carl Darren, who was the chairman of the board at that time, also opposed it to some degree, but it's not real militant-like. But Mr. Wolf was very militant about it. But he was overruled on the board, you know, and by that time, you know, like I say, a lot of articles will back all this up, you know, because it's a lot of them, and I was collecting articles and everything back in those days and making booklets out of them. But other than a little bit there, and I don't think that really got out into the public too much. And then when we finally took the kids up there, it was they took them up there and wasn't no problem.
What did Wolf and Deering say to you?
Well, they didn't. I don't think they ever really talked to me. I was there at the meetings a couple of times, and they just talked in the meeting about it. And I can't remember some of the and what their reasons were at that time. Now I can't remember what it was, but they just opposed integration. And that's when I was trying to tell them about what we needed. And they said, "Well, if we build," and they did go ahead and build a new school on the west side, you know, down there. And but they went ahead and integrated it right off, you know. They went ahead and used the money to build one on that side of town. And next thing you know, we had an integrated school over there on the it's really out on the track, what part we call the track. You know what West Side School is. Yeah, so it was out on that area called the track out there. That's where I grew up on the track, but in the grass off of some too. But when I ended up getting married, I lived out on the track out there.
So was the school board general, was it split on the issue, or did you, were they?
I think this little issue just came up a couple of times, but I think Mr. Wolf and them just kind of fell on in there with it, went on. It was just a concern they had, and they voiced their opinion pretty strongly. Especially Jay Wolf, but then Carl Darren explained in his to a degree. But they didn't just go in and, you know, try to fight it and start a big mess about it. That's just kind of a discussion. And I don't know if it ever got out public. I've been thinking about that later. I've kind of looked at some articles. And I think maybe one of them, a few articles might have indicated that they opposed it. But I don't think it never did get to be a big issue. It was just the only little opposition that I remember that they did.
So you don't remember being threatened in any way, do you remember any of your friends or family being threatened?
Never threatened. And I always thought about that because of what was happening in the South at that time. And used to talk about the Ku Klux Klans and all that kind of stuff and what they were doing in the South and everything. But no, and there was no, when we integrated, the only problem we had, and I think I mentioned this time, in our integration, and I just read about my brother Bruce Miller, who's passed on now, and this booklet here, it's going to be something about him. I'm going to give you one that probably that book is going to be something about him. But when we played one of the towns, and I don't know what town it was, he had a little problem when he got on the football team, because he was the only black on that first time when they integrated on the team, and a bunch of the white kids was kind of looking at him, and when they would be practicing, they just kind of double tackle him. Sometimes two or three of them would hit him and all that, and he could really sense that at that time. But when we went to one school, I don't think it was Llewellyn, Granger, the school he was playing in, or Taylor, one of them schools was it went to play with the white kids. One of the kids tackled him, but when he tackled him, he went down, he deliberately kneed him in the side. Just kneed him in the side. It kind of hurt him, but not real bad. But as a result, it ended up that he had kidney problem after he got grown, and when he died with that, because that's what the doctor said. That injury caused him to have kidney problem. He was on kidney dialysis for about, I think, 30 years. They said he set a record being on a kidney machine or whatever for that long. But that, other than that, but we wasn't having any problems. The teams that we played after we integrated wasn't having any problem with them. It was kind of like Taylor and Round Rock and Granger and all those towns in that district. I don't remember all of them. But we really didn't have no problem, you know, and so a lot of people was kind of sensitive to that because based on what was happening in the South, what they're reading and hearing about in the South, kind of bothered them. And I remember when I got Arca, when Lockhart integrated, no problem, and when Taylor and some of the others, so.
Did the Klan have any kind of presence in the county at that time?
I think it, I've got an article on it, and I think they did kind of have it, but it never was that to that degree where it was real, you know, like it was in the South. I think we organized them. I think I got some pictures with some of them with the white caps on, things like that. But it's just kind of like another organization like the Lions Club, where they was organized, but they wasn't to the degree that they was militant like it was way back when they first got organized, I guess. But I'm not sure, but I think we had one there, but it wasn't no problem, nothing like that.
I did want to ask you, you were a cook at the L&M Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of interested in maybe a description. Could you describe the cafe, what you did there, how long you worked there, who owned it?
Well, I don't remember who owned it now then, and I worked there for several years. And I was ended up being the head cook. I started out kind of like a dishwasher, and I worked my way up to be a head cook there at L&M Cafe. And cooking at that time, when I was cooking in, you know, the black people had to come in the back. They didn't eat, couldn't go up front, you know, and they had to come in the back, and that's the only thing that bothered me, not them coming back in. Because it was a way of life, I didn't think about it, but they was always getting in my way because they kind of had to sit in the table there where I'm cutting meat and you know, making pies along with my other cooks and things like that. And they kind of bothered me a little bit, you know, because they get in my way. And I wasn't bothered about that being, you know, because that was just the way of life, you know. But I kept thinking about it, you know, why couldn't they set up with all them seats up front? And I think I might have told you when my daughter grew up and she got to be about 12 or 13 years old, one day, and I don't know whether my wife brought her to town, how she got up to the L&M Cafe, but the next thing
how
I look, hey, next thing I noticed, it was his mama, next thing I noticed, Chris was sitting at the counter up front, and it was one of the head ladies that worked there. Come back in, and she said, Harvey said, your daughter, and her name was Chubby, so your daughter wants us to order a Coke. What am I supposed to do? I said, well, Chubby, you know what you're supposed to do? Send her back in. What, you know what you're supposed to? And all the white people looking up there, I guess they're saying, what's that little colored girl doing sitting up there? And I found out she deliberately did that because she was pulling tricks like at that age. And then she said, no, I'll go ahead and give her one. But she didn't know Chris was going to leave nothing, so she went and gave Chris a Coke. When she got in, Chris paid for it. She's about 12 or 13. She paid for it and got up and left. And she knew she wasn't come up, wasn't supposed to do that, you know, but she was pulling tricks like that herself. And she got to be kind of famous because of things like that. She ended up working with the Austin Police Department after she got married and things like that. But just like I say, it's kind of a way of life, you know. But I was just sensitive to it. And
so they had to sit in the back, or I guess in the back of the restaurant, or in another room?
No, it was really at this time. In a lot of places, they had to sit back. It kind of had a little place for them to come back in some of the other cafes. But in my cafe there at L&M, and that's one of the biggest cafes there, they had to sit kind of over around the table, and they'd end up, a lot of them, be sitting on the table where I'd be, you know, mixing food and stuff like that.
It's almost in the kitchen.
Yeah, kind of in the kitchen, yeah. They come back to the kitchen and eat. And that was just the way of life, you know. Everybody, and they knew that that was just the way of life. They just go and come on back in and eat, you know.
I imagine that all the school board members, all the prominent people in Georgetown come there and eat.
Yeah, everybody. Oh, man, it was just packed. It was just that was a big cafe for a long time, the L&M Cafe. And like I said, it's just the way of life with everything, you know. Like restrooms. You had a restroom, one says colored and one says white. Now, that's where my daughter's pulled another trick on me. She went to the courthouse, took it to the courthouse one day, and she went inside to use the restroom. So I had to wait outside. And it was taking her so long to come out, I go in there and check. When I get in there, the police got her. Now, I should have known something was wrong, funny, because he started laughing. He said, is this your little girl? I said, yeah. I said, why? What'd she do? She was drinking off the white folks' water fountain. I said, what? And he said, I asked her why, and she said, I just wanted to know if the white folks' water was colder than ours. And that's the reason he started laughing. And she was just pulling him kind of tricks, you know. And instead of that, so she, and then they had a restroom, one colored and one white back in those days and everything. And that's just the way life was, you know. Sit on the back, live on a certain section of town, sit on the back seat of the bus. Eat in the back of the cafe, water fountain. I got pictures now. When people see this, both white and black people see this, they can't believe it. And I got pictures of that now where the water fountain, one says colored up and one says white. Well, restroom, one says colored, one says white, you know. Back in those days. So that's just the way life was.
In addition to L&M, you also did some work at Southwestern?
I cooked up Southwestern University, yeah. I cooked there and... I don't remember doing much other work in that, because I was just mostly, all that time was a cook, you know,
I don't know if you remember, or if you could talk about, kind of some of the lawyers and people you worked with, during, after you had filed the lawsuit, how did that all come about? What kind of effect did that have on your family?
Well, there was no problem. After the lawyer that was going to file the suit, and like I said, he was the same one that was working with him when he integrated Southwest Texas here at that time. They were just helping us, and nobody else had anything to do, had any oppositions to it, you know. There was never no opposition to when they went to school that first year, their affair and everything, and the kids had a little problem. Like I say, some of the kids was having a little problem getting on as a cheerleader, but my daughter, same daughter, ended up being a cheerleader, and my next daughter being a cheerleader. So when they got up there, they just got involved in things in school, and they could join the cheerleading. Some of them got in the band the next year. A lot of them couldn't get into it that first year, but that next year, they was in the, and you know, joined the band a little bit, and some of them. And we used to have a kind of, try to have a Carver school, high school band down in that Carver school, had one down there. And had black cheerleaders, you know, because we was playing football around Taylor and Grange to them when it was, you know, playing the black team for him for the integrate. We was playing football and all that, so. But like I say, everything just went smooth there. And I always admired San Marcos when the Brown Boys Board of Education was passed in 1954 that all schools in America be integrated. And it was in the middle of the term. San Marcos integrated in 1955, the next year, because it was in the middle of the term, and school had already started when the law was passed, so the next year they integrated and had no problems. You know, where at that time I was following suit to integrate, and where other schools was, a lot of schools went ahead and integrated. And then there were a lot of schools that understand, I think I got a few articles that had some opposition and had to file suits and things like that to integrate, but I think Georgetown, to my knowledge, was the only one that actually filed a suit and went through that process. And after went through that process, you know, filing a suit and all that, and they approved it and everything, well, just went on to school and everything went well. So, but we never did have any problem, except a little bit, like I say, and especially didn't have any problem, to my knowledge, at the school after they integrated.
Were you in Georgetown to see integration come to pass, or were you already, had you already moved to San Marcos?
No, my kids, I was there when they went to school and everything, and I got a chance to see it, because after I moved down here in 66, they had already enrolled at the white school. All of them had been in school, was going. And that's when my daughter that lived with me now was a cheerleader, and I had a picture of her when she was a cheerleader.
And how did you feel, like, when that happened,
Well, I was just excited about it. You know, like I say, I was just excited about the community, and I was just so proud of Georgetown and everything, where everything went, you know, because, and I think a lot of people, we wasn't having that much problem in Texas, to my knowledge, and other cities in Texas, but like they were having in the South, Mississippi and Louisiana and Arkansas and Alabama and all that, where they're really having it down there with racial problems, really big. And I used to take the Ebony magazine ever since I was little. My dad and him used to get it, and that's when you always had these articles in the Ebony magazine, and they'd come out in some of the papers about, you know, the Austin American Statements and things like that about the racial problem that they was having in the South. And I got some booklets and stories when they integrate some universities down there, you know, and they went ahead and integrated them, and I got one picture of this girl, first girl, I think, integrated Alabama. And I got showed a picture in the paper where she was walking on campus, and a bunch of white girls were standing back kind of behind, and they just kind of looking at her like, what this colored girl doing? Kind of like what the expression on their face was, and I got that picture in my collection. You know, what this colored girl doing up here? You know, here, you know. But it wasn't no, you know, they didn't have much problem. People was raising Cain and everything down there, but they did have a lot of problems in the South. So that's why we were sensitive. And I don't ever recall any real racial thing issues in the state of Texas, and it might have been. I might look through my collection, but I never did. It's just in the South at that time.
Still, you know, I think doing a little reading about you, I think, like, I just still get a kick out of thinking about that day in 1962 where you took the kids up to, I guess it was Georgetown High School.
That's a high school, yeah.
And wanted to enroll. I mean, that's, I just get a kick out of that. It's just such a bold thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, do you remember what kind of day it was, what the weather was like? I mean, what was it like to do that on that day?
Well, it was a kind of normal day. I see, time to register schools. I see, when do you start registering schools? The kids go to school, and I remember the day itself, before the weather was coming, just kind of normal day and everything.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting to have to do that until this lawyer called me and tell me about it, you know, and he said that if we'll be going to court tomorrow, and I'd already made arrangements to get off my job to go and to go down to Austin to the court and everything, and that's when he called me and said this, and you know, and that's when said we'll be going, and I think he said we'd be going tomorrow, I think, but we had to take the kids. I don't know if we got together and took the kids that day. Well, we had to take them before then, so maybe say we'd be going a few days from now. And that's when I got with this, and I didn't know who to get, because it wasn't my church. The Reverend Gibbon was belonged to the Methodist church down there. And I'm not sure how I ended up with him. Because we had a committee, PTA committee going on, and we used to meet at his church, you know, Parents and Teachers Association, and it was for the Carver. Back in those days, you know, it was segregated. White people had a PTA meeting, and all black schools had to have one too, you know, and so.
So one of the reasons for doing it was that the lawyer explained that if they had a school administrator on the stand, that they couldn't say, well, they never tried it to.
Well, yeah, that's almost the words he said, you know. Say, if I get up and start giving Superintendent Barnes a hard time about it, probably the first thing he's going to say, and it's kind of like the way he phrased it, probably the first thing he's going to say, well, how they know? They never tried to come up there. And he made that remark to me in our conversation, and that's what made me decide to, you know, that's what we need to do.
Yeah, so this and, way, you could say, well, we tried, you wouldn't.
Yeah, that's right, you tried with letters. And it didn't turn out to be a big issue, but that, you know, that's what it's all about, because that's what he was saying, you know. And they were just shocked when we came up there, and, you know, to make that approach them on that. Like I say, I'll show you the articles in the booklet, and I'll just give you a set of it, take with you. But I was just shocked that everything wasn't so great compared, and I was just comparing it with the things that was happening in the South at the time.
What do you think? Because the way you describe it, it seems like the integration process in Georgetown was fairly smooth.
Yeah.
What do you think the elements were that made that possible? I mean, in other words, what was unique about Georgetown and the people involved in the integration process that was different than what was happening in Alabama or Mississippi? What was the difference?
I don't know. I think the community at that time, we were communicating with Southwestern University in some areas. They had some special organized programs they had organized there to work with the black kids in the community. And a lot of things were just voluntarily going on. And a lot of it was with the Southwestern University students and things like that, you know. And just being a way of life, you know, about, you know, going in the back door cafe and stuff like that. And I can't remember now when that kind of changed, at what point that changed at. But just kind of way of life. And we were just... wasn't having any problems there, you know, racial problems, because nobody was trying to break the color line, one thing. But when after the schools integrated and the kids got to getting to know each other, you know, going to school and getting to know each other, and parents, I guess, and things like that. So things just started to just kind of filtering in. And to my knowledge, some other people in the interview may remember some things happening, but it just... everything just kind of went smooth. And I was kind of shocked and surprised. Like I say, I didn't realize I was expecting, really, and didn't know why I was expecting my community to react. I guess because of the way they reacted in the South when they talk about this, but when they integrated and took the kids up there and stuff like that, well, just, you know, everything went fine. And I don't know at what point we could start using all the same restrooms, and I can't remember when that might have happened. But, you know, just, you know, when they go in the courthouse, you know, they had a restroom, I think they had a restroom when they set up their color and, you know, like that, you know. But, I don't know. And then, like I say, you had to go in the back door of the cafe, or you had to go in the back room of the cafe or whatever it was. So, I don't know. It was just a way of life and everything, and I think what I've just admired, Georgetown, when this all happened, it just kind of filtered right in, you know. There was a lot of articles in Williams County, so I had a lot of articles in the paper that could be coming out from time to time. And
how important do you think, and this is something I haven't really heard discussed too often, how important do you think Southwestern's role in the whole integration process in Georgetown was?
Well, I think that was one of the major roles. I can't recall, and some other people might recall, but I can't recall any other efforts. And then I was shocked when Southwestern made this move, and especially being teachers, and you could have probably thought about some of the other residents that's going to have to pay the tax money for a segregated school, and maybe a lot of residents, they just felt like that's the way of life, it's okay, you know. But I never did realize why Southwestern University become so involved all of a sudden. And it wasn't because I had cooked up there, because I don't think they knew me that much, because of that. But if I cooked up there one time, and I can't remember exactly what stage it was prior to that, but I don't know if it's just some of the faculty members. And I don't know if, and I think my doctor, Douglas Minow, was my doctor, and he was kind of involved in helping to get integrated. And I went and talked with him way back, and when we had that car reunion, after it had been integrated for years, we started having a car reunion and get all the Carver students, ex-students come around there, and that's when we'd invite them, and then we'd specifically invite white people, you know. We'd have a car reunion, but we raised it, and I don't know if any of them remembered or how I said it, but I always put an article in the paper and said, you know, the community's invited, because I had a little theory there. Because some issue came up one time, but you can't practice that, fight integration if you go practice it. You know, so whatever we had for the black kids, and the white kids could do it too, you know. And I always used to say that. So when we have meetings and things like that, this is open to the public. And, you know, a lot of times a few white people come. So we had some white people come to the car reunion with us, you know, and some of us teachers, things like that, you know. And then,
I know you played a big role in integration, but are there other people that come to mind, like, who, white or black, who played a really important role in making it happen in Georgetown?
Well, I think probably the people on the parents and teachers, PTA, a lot of them went ahead and most of them supported it. And the article that I have has got the names of who they are, who was on the PTA that supported it. That supported the integration, you know, and so that, and it wasn't no, just a few of them that opposed it because of the connections, you know, like that, you know, and I know one lady, and she went on to be a teacher there, and I won't call her name, because she get on me every time I go to Georgetown, but it ended up being, ended up being, you know, good for her, because she taught it to Carver, I think. Then she ended up teaching up there at the white school. And sometimes people up there, even sometimes, you know, they say, Harvey said he did this and he did that and everything. And on the way back, everything's up is I have articles. And I was a fanatic about writing articles. I'd go put an article in the paper about it and whatever, you know. And but other than that, The black community and everyone at that time just, you know, it just fell right in with it. It's just like I say, a few of them opposed it at first because they would take away their relationship because they thought sometimes the black teacher, and I read an article earlier today in one of the books, I think it was in this book, where they said that the black kids had a better relation with a black teacher than they did with a white teacher. That's what some of the remarks are making.
Huh? Did you agree with that?
Well, I didn't agree with it because I felt like it. All the things with how my kids got along and my brother Bruce and my relatives got along up there, that everything went fine. And I think I never recall any problem with white teachers was any different with black kids than they were with white kids or Hispanic kids at that time. But some of them were just saying that. That's some of the objections that they were using, you know. And I think in this booklet there was an article in the paper. I put together a booklet, an article in the paper later, come out, and some of them talked about this. And then they had an article in the paper where they interviewed a lot of black people in this booklet are made. It goes on to say what the different what them said about different things, but I don't recall anybody having any problem or any real major objective to it, you know. And even though they didn't have a choice, once they integrated, they didn't have a choice but to let the kids go there, you know. But I don't recall offhand now.
Well, Harvey, we got about